As many of you may know, I like movies, and so one of my favorite movies is a cult classic from 1984, The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension. All of you are familiar with that, well, big hit, right? Strange, bizarre movie. The hero, Buckaroo Banzai, is a neurosurgeon, rock star, scientist, crime fighter. But the big part of the story that I want to share with you, it's an interesting, amusing movie, but the part I want to share with you is, so Buckaroo Banzai has this moment where he's attempted to travel through dimensions using his jet car. And then after that, he receives this phone call. And while he's on the phone call, he receives an electric shock through the phone. And what the electric shock through the phone allows him to do is to see the world differently. He notices that these people in this factory that he's at aren't really people. In fact, they're electroids from Planet 10 across the eighth dimension. And then eventually he and his crime-fighting unit, they find a way to develop a way so they can also see the electroids. But what happens here is Buckaroo Banzai is able to see the world in a different way. He's looked around the world and he's seen things in one way, and he thinks that these are normal factory workers, when in fact they're aliens. And the book of Revelation functions much the same way. It's not an electric shock. And so sometimes we read, you hear the book of Revelation, and if you're not familiar with it, or maybe you've tried to dive into it a little bit, it seems like this bizarre, strange, there's all these fantastical images and crazy things going on in the book, and it can seem really hard to do. But we started a series a few weeks back, and one of the things that I want us to continue to encourage to think about with the book of Revelation is one of its primary purposes, and even it comes in the title, so Revelation is a translation of the Greek word apokalypto, or we think apocalypse, we think end of the world, but it just means an unveiling, a revealing. It's a way to see the world differently. And so today we're going to take a look at chapter 5 and how it invites us to see the world differently, how it maybe gives us a little shock, and all of a sudden what we think we see and what's really there are two different things. And so, as I said, the book of Revelation is a record of what this man named John experienced, a vision on the island of Patmos. And he's been unveiling this vision that has been given to him by Jesus and about Jesus. And so we're going to look at chapter 5 today, but chapter 4 and 5 really go together. We did chapter 4 last week. Chapter 4 introduces John. All of a sudden, he's taken and he sees heaven. And by heaven, we mean God's space, the dimension in which God lives. And we see God sitting on a throne. He's the Almighty. He's reigning over things in all of heaven and earth. And we're invited to see this and God's rule over these things, as well as the way that all of creation worships God. And today we're going to turn to chapter 5, which is really part of that same vision. We're going to kind of go through the vision kind of quickly and then go back and kind of catch some highlights of what it means. And so remember, chapter 4. Chapter 4 has, at the center of this vision, there's a throne, and around the throne are these four living creatures, and then the 24 elders, and they're in worship, and there's this sense of authority, and the calls for worship and allegiance, and then the vision shifts. And it says, then I saw, so John sees in the right hand of him who sat on the throne, a scroll with writing on both sides and sealed with seven seals. So again, we're back to the throne here. And he saw a mighty angel proclaiming in a loud voice, who is worthy to break the seals and open the scroll? So what is John? John sees a scroll. Scrolls were one of the common ways that writing was done in the ancient world. And it was not the typical way to write on both sides. It happened occasionally, but it was written on both sides and then sealed with seven seals. And so what that meant was typically there was some sort of hot wax poured on them and then a ring or a signet, some sort of imprint placed on those seals to seal it up. And what did that do? That prevented it from being tampered with. It guaranteed what it is, that it's intact. And what's on the scroll? I'm not entirely sure, but it seems that it's likely about God's plan to judge and to save the world. That here is all of God's plans, his outworking of his attempt to save, or of his goal, his plan to save the world. And this angel said, who's worthy to open it? Who has the authority, the ability based on who they are or what they've done to open it? So you can imagine this angel, the angel's voice is booming out across all of creation, saying, who is worthy? And then John says, but no one in heaven or on earth, that's a way of saying anywhere, in heaven or on earth, all the places or under the earth could open the scroll or even look inside it. And John goes on, I wept and wept because no one was found who was worthy to open the scroll or look inside. No one could open it, and John weeps. Why? Because if God's plan can't be opened, if it can't be carried out, then the evil in the world won't be judged. If God's plan can't be carried out, there's no protection of God's people. If God's plan can't be carried out, there's no ultimate triumph. So John is weeping. He's thinking, I've seen God on the throne, but his plans can't be opened. It can't be executed because no one is worthy to open the seals. And then one of the elders, so remember again from chapter 4, there are these 24 elders representing probably the tribes of Israel and the apostles sitting around the throne. One says, don't weep. See, look, the Lion of Judah, the Root of David has triumphed. He is able to open the scroll and its seven seals. And so he's inviting this image, the Lion of Judah from the Old Testament, and the image of the Root of David is this royal lineage, this picture of the Great One. And so now I want you to imagine you're John. And you're sitting there and you've been weeping because the seals containing God's plans can't be opened. And then this elder says, don't weep. He says, look, the Lion of Judah. And you kind of have this picture in your head. You're starting, if you're John, you're maybe starting to imagine this great lion coming. An image of what? A lion. Image of power and majesty. I mean, no one messes with lions. And there's this picture, maybe you have a picture in your head of a lion racing forward, and this lion's going to come and grab the scroll and just use its giant jaws and rip the seals open. And you're standing and you're looking, and the elder has said, don't weep, because there, look, the Lion of Judah. It's like, look, the Lion of Judah. And you turn and you look, and I saw a lamb looking as if it had been slain, standing at the center of the throne, encircled by the four living creatures and the elders. The Lamb had seven horns and seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of God sent out into all the earth. We were at the zoo last week, and the animals were actually out a little bit over at John Ball Zoo, and we were going. And one of the things that often, if you visit the zoo, is you're sitting there and you come to the enclosure where the animals are, and you're looking to figure out where the animals are. Because sometimes they're way off, and especially the larger ones, like where the lion is. And it's maybe way in the back, or the tiger, and they're up on top of a rock, or they're hiding in the thing. And so sometimes maybe another visitor at the zoo will say, look, he's over there. Now imagine you go to the zoo and you go to the lion enclosure. And you're there at the lion enclosure and said, look, the lion. And you look, and there's a little lamb. As if it's been slain, its throat's covered in blood. You think, wait a minute, you said there was a lion. He says, look, a lion. You see a lamb. This is what John experiences. As one scholar says this, it's perhaps the most mind-wrenching rebirth of images in literature. This total change, this total unexpected thing that happens where John expects to see one thing and sees something completely different. He sees a lamb that looks as if it's slaughtered, but now is alive. So it's died, but it's risen. Now, it's never directly identified as Jesus, but it's clear that's who we're talking about. And he's standing at the center of the throne. And you think, wait a minute, there's already somebody on the throne. God's already on the throne. So now we have the lamb standing at the center of the throne, the same place God. It has seven horns and seven eyes. So this is not only a slaughtered lamb was alive, it's a bizarre looking lamb. But remember now, the book of Revelation is apocalypse, it's unveiling, and it uses symbols, it invites our imagination. And so we see that it has seven horns, which represent power, it has seven eyes, which represent wisdom. And the number seven means completeness or wholeness. So this is a lamb, it's a lamb, but it's got power. It's a lamb and it's got wisdom, isn't able to see. And what does the lamb do? It says the lamb went and took the scroll from the right hand of him who sat on the throne. And when he had taken it, the four living creatures and the 24 elders fell down before the Lamb. And each one had a harp. They were holding golden bowls full of incense, which are the prayers of God's people. So what does the Lamb do? It goes and it takes the scroll. So this scroll that John thought no one could open. And the four living creatures and the 24 elders fall down and worship. Now, if you're reading and you're hearing John describe this vision and you've just heard his vision from chapter 4, it has told us there is only one in all of creation worthy of worship. That's the one sitting on the throne. And now all of a sudden, they're worshiping the Lamb. In other words, the Lamb is being worshiped, that God shares his honor and sovereignty with Messiah Jesus. Worship is what marks the difference between the creator and the created. To worship the creator, to worship the creature is idolatry. So it's telling us this Lamb is one with God. And not only do they fall down and worship, they sing a new song. I would invite you, even if you're kind of confused by Revelation 7, just go through and read the songs. There's a whole bunch of different songs and they can provide. And it says, you are worthy to take the scroll and to open its seals because you were slain. Pay attention to that. What makes the Lamb worthy to open the seal? If slain. And with your blood, you purchased for God persons from every tribe and language and people and nation. Pay attention to that. Every tribe, language, people, and nation. So it's a new song because something new has happened. There's some new revelation, and so they break out in a new song. And what is the new song about? That the Lamb is worthy. Alan Bozak, a South African commentator on the book of Revelation, says this: he does not open the scroll because he has the ability to enforce or cajole, coerce or deceive. He is found worthy. And again, what makes the Lamb worthy? He was slain. Because he was slain and purchased people. And I said what? Every tribe, language, nation, people. Four. Revelation, numbers are important. Seven means completeness. Four is also a sign of completeness of the earth. We talked a little bit about that last week. We talked about north, south, east, and west, the four corners of the earth. So when he says every language, nation, tribe, and people, and this kind of phrase shows up a number of times in the book of Revelation, you read that, that means everybody. And he's purchased, he's ransomed, he's brought for himself these people, and they will serve. And it says, you have made them to be a kingdom and priests to serve our God, and they will reign on the earth. And then what happens? So you've got first the four living creatures, the 24 elders. The Lamb comes, takes the scroll. The living creatures, the elders burst out in worship. And then it's like there's this cascade. It just goes out and out and out. It says, then I looked and I heard the voices of many angels numbering thousands upon thousands and 10,000 times 10,000. How many is that? A lot, right? There's a whole bunch of, they encircled the throne. So we've got living creatures, elders, and then 10,000 times 10,000 angels out there. And in a loud voice, they were saying, worthy is the Lamb who was slain to receive power and wealth and wisdom and strength and honor, glory and praise. How many? Seven. In other words, complete things. And then I heard every creature in heaven and on earth and under the earth and on the sea. We got it again. Four. Saying, to him who sits on the throne and to the Lamb be praise and honor and glory and power. There four times, forever and ever. So matching the living creatures again. And the four living creatures said amen, and the elders fell down and worshiped. So we get this big amen at this cascade of worship, and they fall down and worship again. So here it is. It's this, since John weeping, who can open the seal? Look, it's a lion. No, it's a lamb. A lamb that was slain. And the slain lamb comes and takes the scroll. And all of creation, from the living creatures to the elders to the spiritual beings, who we call angels, out to every creature on heaven and on earth and under the earth and in the sea, bursts out in worship. And what does this do? It's inviting us to see the world in a different way, to see world in a different way. Remember, it's an apocalypse. It's an unveiling. It purges our imagination of all that we see, and it refills it. So this is key. Absolutely key. If you want to read the book of Revelation, read well, is to read. Everything builds to this image. So the preceding chapters build this image, and everything else flows from it. So at the center, in some sense, we say, well, we're only in chapter 4 and 5, but this is the center of John's vision. Everything else comes from this. Everything else will be unintelligible without chapters 4 and 5. In other words, what we're asked to understand is we have to see the world through this vision, through the vision of the God upon the throne and the Lamb upon the throne. That God is upon the throne and he shares his sovereignty, his authority with the Lamb who is the one who was slain. And that's how we have to see the world. We have to look through that set of glasses, not through MSNBC or through Fox, but to see this vision helps us understand what is happening. And that's kind of the key thing I want to initial take home, and then we'll take some five takeaways from that. But this is the big idea, that the central and centering image of Revelation is the lamb that was slaughtered. And one of the things as I read and study more about the book of Revelation is it's amazing how John is structured and put it together. Jesus is described as a lamb 28 times in the book of Revelation. If you go back to grade school math, what are the factors of 28? 7 times 4. 7, the number of perfection, 4, all of creation. 28 times Jesus described, and it's this picture. And so we realize that this is the image that guides us through the book of Revelation, that Jesus, the lamb who was slaughtered, is sitting on the throne. Michael Gorman says it this way. He said it is the central and centering image, the governing metaphor, the focal point of Revelation. He doesn't want us to miss this. A slaughtered lamb, a crucified Lord. This is what draws the book of Revelation together. It's the way we see it. It's the thing that guides all of the book. In other words, we have to read every passage with that image in mind and keep it there. We have to keep the slain lamb as our guiding image. We have to see everything through that. And so we're going to think five things about the significance of the slain lamb. One, where is the lamb in this image? On the throne. At the center of reality, the lamb is in the middle of the throne. God is there. He's in the center of God. Since Jesus is worshipped, he's included in God. Jesus isn't an alternative object of worship, but the one who fully shares God's glory. The lamb is on the throne in all praise. Remember, every creature on earth and under the earth and on the sea and under, all directed towards the lamb. So we want to keep that in mind as we're reading through, and as we start next week and we talk about seals and bowls and trumpets, we have to keep in mind there's a slain lamb at the center of the image. That's the image, and that lamb is on the throne. That's number one. Number two, this is how God wins. This is absolutely crucial. How does God win? How does God defeat the powers? By being slain. We think back, there's this lion. Remember, John, look, there's a lion. No, it's a lamb. Richard Hayes, the great ethicist, says it this way. He says, the shock of this reversal discloses the central mystery of the apocalypse. And that's what he's calling the book of Revelation. God overcomes the world, not through a show of force, but through the suffering and death of Jesus, the faithful witness, or the martus, which is the Greek word for witness, in chapter 1, verse 5. The shock of this reversal, of thinking it's a lion, but seeing a lamb as if it's slain, this is how God overcomes the world. The lamb is worthy to open the seal. Why? Because it's been slain and it's purchased through its death, through its blood, through its, has purchased for itself a people. This is what we need to see. That Christ is victorious. And how does he win? By dying. He conquers by a cross-shaped, a cruciform, faithful resistance. Not by inflicting violence, but by absorbing violence. Not by killing, but with a sword. And you think, oh, no, wait. Later on in the book, we see Jesus is on a big horse, and he's all buff, and he's got a sword. Read that verse again. Read that chapter again. Where is Jesus' sword coming out of his mouth? And you think, wow, he's got blood all on his robe. The blood is on his robe before he even gets there. It's his own blood. He conquers through the power of his word. And the book of Revelation is a challenge to Rome and all of the world's powers and theology of victory and power. This is lamb power. Brian Blount, a commentator, talks about it this way. He says, it doesn't work well. I didn't write it up on here. He talks about slaughtered lamb power. And he abbreviates it as small s, capital L-A-M-B, slam. This is slam. This is slaughtered lamb power. This is what it looks like. And so he talks about God slamming the evil powers, because slaughtered lamb power is death. Slaughtered lamb power, this is the power of God. And so one of the things we realize that God has won, this is how God wins, is through this. Not only that, God has already won. So we're working from victory, and we see where history is headed. So as we read this, it's not a vision to induce fear and trembling in us. Instead, it's a vision to induce confidence and say, the Lamb has overcome. The powers of evil have been defeated, and the Lamb is on the throne, and we see where victory is headed. Number three, that this is not only how God wins, but how God rules. Not only did God win by being slain, by the Lamb being slain, but this is how he rules. And so we go back again and again. It's this reversal from the lion to the lamb. Look, the lion. No, the lamb. So Richard Bauckham, in his theology of the book of Revelation, said, when the slaughtered lamb is seen in the midst of the divine throne in heaven, the meaning is that Christ's sacrificial death belongs to the way God rules the world. The symbol of the lamb is no less a divine symbol than the symbol of the one who sits on the throne. Would you pay attention? The meaning is that Christ's sacrificial death belongs to the way God rules. God rules the world in the same way he won the world, the same way he conquered. The one on the throne, the exalted Lord, remains the crucified Jesus. One writer says that this is the true face of God. When we see the slaughtered lamb, the lamb who's slain, we're seeing the true face of God. And if we forget that, if we forget that that's what God is like, it will make every reading in the New Testament problematic. We have to understand lamb power, or else divine power and justice will be misunderstood. Especially when we get, like I said, we're getting to this next part where we talk about seals and bowls and trumpets, and there's going to be all kinds of... When you start reading those, go back and say, at the center of this all is a God who won by dying and a God who rules in the same way. And it will put those judgments and everything else in perspective. It's a choice between the power that operates through inflicting suffering. That's one kind of power. That's the world's power. That was the power of Rome. Rome imposed what they call the Pax Romana, this great peace across the empire. And you know how they did it? Through the legions, their armies. That's how most of the time, when I was in the military, we talked about peacemaking operations. Well, we didn't make peace by going and talking to people. The way the army makes peace is by going and bombing them into peace. That's the power of the world. The power that inflicts, that's the power of what Revelation calls the beast. But this power, the lamb power, is the power that operates through accepting suffering. That's the power of the lamb. And so when we think about God, this is how God rules, is through this same way. So we have the fact that the Lamb is on the throne. He overcomes by being slain, and he rules in the same way. And then this, the way of the Lamb is also our way. So we're invited to follow Jesus. Later on in the book of Revelation, that language is to follow the Lamb. Remember earlier it said that Jesus has purchased for himself a kingdom to be priests. In other words, to be his representatives, to reign in his place, to reign with him. And that reign comes from faithfulness. And the work is continued by his followers. So we're looking at, he's inviting us to that same sort of thing. That if we're to be the followers of Jesus, when you're inviting to follow someone, we learn that as kids, right? The game, follow the leader. If the leader does something, what do you do? You're supposed to do the same thing, right? And so if we're called to follow the Lamb, and this was the basis of discipleship for the Hebrews, a rabbi, when they invited someone to be their disciple, they were to imitate the rabbi in all that he did. And so in the same way, when we're invited to follow the Lamb, when we're invited to follow Jesus, we're invited the same way. So Brian Blount, the commentator I mentioned earlier, he says, God's victorious way is the slaughtered way. It not only describes the path God's son took, it prescribes the path God's people will take on their way to the new heaven and new earth. Their combative efforts will help God create. And he uses the word combative, but it's the way of the Lamb. This way of suffering, the way of giving. So the way of the Lamb is counter to the way of the world. It's the Sermon on the Mount way. We did a series on that last year. You know, blessed are the peacemakers. Blessed are the meek. Blessed are the poor. Blessed are you who are persecuted for the sake of righteousness. When someone strikes you on the cheek, turn the other cheek. Love your enemy. Pray for those who persecute you. That's the way of the Lamb. Jesus takes what seems like crazy and turns the world upside down and says, this is what it looks like. This is what it looks like to follow me. And so we have to get that in our head. To follow Jesus is the same way. And the other thing that Jesus does here is he redefines winning. He redefines winning because when Rome, when the powers and the religious authorities put Jesus to death, they were probably thinking, we won. But death does not mean defeat for the followers of Jesus. So what we're called to do is in word and deed bear witness to the truth, to remain faithful. That's what Jesus was. He remained faithful to God, even to the point of death. And we're called as his followers to do the same, to remain faithful to him. We could also talk about prayer. We're not going to have time to do it, but notice back there was that little line in there about each one had a harp and they were holding a golden bowl full of incense, which are the prayers of God's people. There's this incredible picture of that our prayers, and they don't have to be elaborate, they don't have to be perfect, they don't have to be anything, are in bowls around the throne of God as incense, which means they're this pleasing thing, which means God enjoys hearing our prayers, that the prayers we offer up are this fragrant and pleasing scent that comes before God. And so as his followers, we're invited to do that. We're invited to pray. And you think, well, I'm not very good at praying. It doesn't say the good prayers, the elaborate prayers, the theologically correct prayers. It just says the prayers of God's people. So everyone who has been purchased, when our prayers are offered up, we're invited to see. Now, are there literally big bowls with our prayers? No, it's our imagination. That's shaped, and we're invited to say, my prayers are part of these bowls that are going up and rising up before God. So we have that fifth and final one, that what we see through this picture of the Lamb at the center is we are not alone in our suffering. So the Lamb who sits at the center of the throne, the one who reigns over all of creation, the one to whom all worship is directed, understands and knows suffering. Alan Bosack, the commentator I mentioned earlier, is a South African, writes on the book of Revelation, and he talks about some of the horrors of apartheid. And he tells a number of different stories about things, including these little children who were locked in a building and the building set on fire, and wondering the question, what do we say to the parents of that? And what Bosack says essentially is the only one who can answer that, the only one who's qualified, is the one who suffered, is the one who can answer our questions, the one who suffered for us. And so he's wanting us to paint us this picture. So as we're asking the questions, which we all do in the midst of suffering and pain, as we see the world around us, or maybe we've experienced our own pain, or maybe the pain of a loved one, is to know that we are not alone in that suffering. That the one who is sitting on the throne of all of creation, the one who offered his life for us, is also one who suffered. And so we're invited to realize we are not alone in that. So we're invited to see the world through this vision John gave us, to have our imagination reshaped, to see that the Lamb who was slain stands and is alive. He is on the throne and has won the victory. And so depending on where you are, you may need to hear a different part of that vision. You may be wondering, you may be looking around the world and saying, the world seems to be falling apart. And I don't know. And it's saying, the Lamb is on the throne. You may feel like you're on the outside and you're not sure what's going on. And the invitation then to you is, there is one who died for you and has purchased you and made you to be his people. And he invites you to put your faith and your trust in him. Or it may be a question of, what is God like? You may be wondering, what is God like? And does he rule like Rome? Does he rule like the empire where he crushes us down and say, no, he rules with love and with Lamb power? As you look around, you say, well, God doesn't seem to be. And as we look through the things going on, we say there's one on the throne, the one who is the slaughtered Lamb, and he's ruling and reigning. We see one who has claimed us for his own by his death. Or maybe you're wondering, how do I follow Jesus in this world? What's the call to follow Jesus? And the call to follow Jesus is to follow the Lamb and to look like the Lamb. to live that same kind of life. And you say, well, that's a scary kind of life. I could lose my life. I could lose my job. And Jesus says, yeah, that's part of it. But none of those things have the final say because the Lamb has overcome. Or maybe you're just saying, I can't do any of those things right now because I'm just in this midst of pain and suffering. And what the vision invites you to see is that you're not alone in that suffering. That there is one who's sitting on the throne who understands and knows suffering. And your prayers, whether they're silent or just groans and moans, are rising up as incense before the throne of God. So I don't know where you are or what you need to hear, but those are what John is inviting us to see in this vision. We're invited to follow the Lamb and enter into this. But in the end, we're also invited to worship, to join with all of creation in these words. And so I'm going to invite us to say them together. These words that are directed to the one who was on the throne to say, worthy is the Lamb who was slain to receive power and wealth and wisdom and strength and honor and glory and praise. To him who sits on the throne and to the Lamb be praise and honor and glory and power forever and ever. Amen.